A Journey to the Center of the Earth. Chapter 1. My uncle makes a great discovery. Looking back to all that has occurred to me since that eventful day, I am scarcely able to believe in the reality of my adventures. They were truly so wonderful that even now I am bewildered when I think of them. My uncle was a German, having married my mother's sister, an Englishwoman. Being very much attached to his fatherless nephew, he invited me to study under him in his home in the fatherland. This home was in a large town, and my uncle a professor of philosophy, chemistry, geology, mineralogy, and many other ologies. One day, after passing some hours in the laboratory, my uncle being absent at the time, I suddenly felt the necessity of renovating the tissues I was hungry, and was about to rouse up our old French cook, when my uncle, Professor von Hardwig, suddenly opened the street door, and came rushing upstairs. Now Professor Hardwig, my worthy uncle, is by no means a bad sort of man, he is, however, choleric and original. To bear with him means to obey, and scarcely had his heavy feet resounded within our joint domicile than he shouted for me to attend upon him. Harry, Harry, Harry. I hastened to obey, but before I could reach his room, jumping three steps at a time, he was stamping his right foot upon the landing. Harry, he cried, in a frantic tone, are you coming up? Now to tell the truth, at that moment I was far more interested in the question as to what was to constitute our dinner than in any problem of science. To me soup was more interesting than soda, an omelette more tempting than arithmetic, and an artichoke of 10 times more value than any amount of asbestos. But my uncle was not a man to be kept waiting, so adjourning therefore all minor questions, I presented myself before him. He was a very learned man. Now most persons in this category supply themselves with information, as peddlers do with goods, for the benefit of others, and lay up stores in order to diffuse them abroad for the benefit of society in general. Not so my excellent uncle, Professor Hardwig. He studied, he consumed the midnight oil, he pored over heavy tomes, and digested huge quartos and folios in order to keep the knowledge acquired to himself. There was a reason, and it may be regarded as a good one, why my uncle objected to display his learning more than was absolutely necessary. He stammered, and when intent upon explaining the phenomena of the heavens, was apt to find himself at fault, and allude in such a vague way to sun, moon, and stars that few were able to comprehend his meaning. To tell the honest truth, when the right word would not come, it was generally replaced by a very powerful adjective. In connection with the sciences there are many almost unpronounceable names very much resembling those of Welsh villages, and my uncle being very fond of using them, his habit of stammering was not thereby improved. In fact, there were periods in his discourse when he would finally give up and swallow his discomfiture in a glass of water. As I said, my uncle, Professor Hardwig, was a very learned man, and I now add a most kind relative. I was bound to him by the double ties of affection and interest. I took deep interest in all his doings, and hoped some day to be almost as learned myself. It was a rare thing for me to be absent from his lectures. Like him, I preferred mineralogy to all the other sciences. My anxiety was to gain real-eye knowledge of the earth. Geology and mineralogy were to us the sole objects of life, and in connection with these studies many a fair specimen of stone, chalk, or metal did we break with our hammers. Steel rods, lodestones, glass pipes, and bottles of various acids were oftener before us than our meals. My uncle Hardwig was once known to classify 600 different geological specimens by their weight, hardness, fusibility, sound, taste, and smell. He corresponded with all the great, learned, and scientific men of the age. I was, therefore, in constant communication with, at all events, the letters of Sir Humphrey Davy, Captain Franklin, and other great men. But before I state the subject on which my uncle wished to confer with me, I must say a word about his personal appearance. Alas! My readers will see a very different portrait of him at a future time, after he has gone through the fearful adventures yet to be related. My uncle was 50 years old, tall, thin, and wiry. Large spectacles hid, to a certain extent, his vast, round, and goggle eyes, while his nose was irreverently compared to a thin file. So much indeed did it resemble that useful article, that a compass was said in his presence to have made considerable an nasal deviation. The truth being told, however, the only article really attracted to my uncle's nose was tobacco. Another peculiarity of his was, that he always stepped a yard at a time, clenched his fists as if he were going to hit you, and was, when in one of his peculiar humors, very far from a pleasant companion. It is further necessary to observe that he lived in a very nice house, in that very nice street, the Königstrasse at Hamburg. Though lying in the center of a town, it was perfectly rural in its aspect, half wood, half bricks, with old-fashioned gables, one of the few old houses spared by the Great Fire of 1842. When I say a nice house, I mean a handsome house, old, tottering, and not exactly comfortable to English notions, a house a little off the perpendicular and inclined to fall into the neighboring canal, exactly the house for a wandering artist to depict, all the more that you could scarcely see it for ivy and a magnificent old tree which grew over the door. My uncle was rich, his house was his own property, while he had a considerable private income. To my notion, the best part of his possessions was his goddaughter, Gretchen. And the old cook, the young lady, the professor and I were the sole inhabitants. I loved mineralogy, I loved geology. To me there was nothing like pebbles, and if my uncle had been in a little less of a fury, we should have been the happiest of families. To prove the excellent Hardwig's impatience, I solemnly declare that when the flowers in the drawing-room pots began to grow, he rose every morning at 4 o'clock to make them grow quicker by pulling the leaves. Having described my uncle, I will now give an account of our interview. He received me in his study, a perfect museum, containing every natural curiosity that can well be imagined, minerals, however, predominating. Everyone was familiar to me, having been catalogued by my own hand. My uncle, apparently oblivious of the fact that he had summoned me to his presence, was absorbed in a book. He was particularly fond of early editions, tall copies, and unique works. "Wonderful!" he cried, tapping his forehead. "Wonderful, wonderful!" It was one of those yellow-leafed volumes now rarely found on stalls, and to me it appeared to possess but little value. My uncle, however, was in raptures. He admired its binding, the clearness of its characters, the ease with which it opened in his hand, and repeated aloud, half a dozen times, that it was very, very old. To my fancy he was making a great fuss about nothing, but it was not my province to say so. On the contrary, I professed considerable interest in the subject, and asked him what it was about. "It is the Heimskringla of Snorre Tarlson," he said, "the celebrated Icelandic author of the 12th century. It is a true and correct account of the Norwegian princes who reigned in Iceland." My next question related to the language in which it was written. I hoped at all events it was translated into German. My uncle was indignant at the very thought, and declared he wouldn't give a penny for a translation. His delight was to have found the original work in the Icelandic tongue, which he declared to be one of the most magnificent and yet simple idioms in the world, while at the same time its grammatical combinations were the most varied known to students. "About as easy as German?" was my insidious remark. My uncle shrugged his shoulders. "The letters at all events," I said, "are rather difficult of comprehension." "It is a runic manuscript, the language of the original population of Iceland, invented by Odin himself," cried my uncle, angry at my ignorance. I was about to venture upon some misplaced joke on the subject, when a small scrap of parchment fell out of the leaves. Like a hungry man snatching at a morsel of bread, the professor seized it. It was about 5 inches by 3 and was scrawled over in the most extraordinary fashion. The lines shown here are an exact facsimile of what was written on the venerable piece of parchment, and have wonderful importance, as they induced my uncle to undertake the most wonderful series of adventures which ever fell to the lot of human beings. My uncle looked keenly at the document for some moments and then declared that it was runic. The letters were similar to those in the book, but then what did they mean? This was exactly what I wanted to know. Now, as I had a strong conviction that the runic alphabet and dialect were simply an invention to mystify poor human nature, I was delighted to find that my uncle knew as much about the matter as I did, which was nothing. At all events, the tremulous motion of his fingers made me think so. "And yet," he muttered to himself, "it is old Icelandic, I am sure of it." And my uncle ought to have known, for he was a perfect polyglot dictionary in himself. He did not pretend, like a certain learned pundit, to speak the 2,000 languages and 4,000 idioms made use of in different parts of the globe, but he did know all the more important ones. It is a matter of great doubt to me now, to what violent measures my uncle's impetuosity might have led him, had not the clock struck 2, and our old French cook called out to let us know that dinner was on the table. "Bother the dinner!" cried my uncle. But as I was hungry, I sallied forth to the dining room, where I took up my usual quarters. Out of politeness I waited 3 minutes, but no sign of my uncle, the professor. I was surprised. He was not usually so blind to the pleasure of a good dinner. It was the acme of German luxury: parsley soup, a ham omelette with sorrel trimmings, an oyster of veal stewed with prunes, delicious fruit, and sparkling Moselle. For the sake of poring over this musty old piece of parchment, my uncle forbore to share a meal. To satisfy my conscience, I ate for both. The old cook and housekeeper was nearly out of her mind. After taking so much trouble, to find her master not appear at dinner was to her a sad disappointment which, as she occasionally watched the havoc I was making on the viands, became also alarm. If my uncle were to come to table after all? Suddenly, just as I had consumed the last apple and drunk the last glass of wine, a terrible voice was heard at no great distance. It was my uncle roaring for me to come to him. I made very nearly one leap of it so loud, so fierce was his tone. Chapter 2. The Mysterious Parchment. Illustration, runic glyphs. I declare, cried my uncle, striking the table fiercely with his fist, I declare to you it is runic and contains some wonderful secret, which I must get at any price. I was about to reply when he stopped me. Sit down, he said, quite fiercely, and write to my dictation. I obeyed. I will substitute, he said, a letter of our alphabet for that of the runic, we will then see what that will produce. Now, begin and make no mistakes. The dictation commenced with the following incomprehensible result. RNLLSS rule seek chdes gtssmf untief nidrik kt, samitrate se adrenamt ni I nu I actral se atvr. NSCRC ob ccd rmi u tulfran 2 dt, IACS ibuketi. Scarcely giving me time to finish, my uncle snatched the document from my hands and examined it with the most rapt and deep attention. I should like to know what it means, he said, after a long period. I certainly could not tell him, nor did he expect me to, his conversation being uniformly answered by himself. I declare it puts me in mind of a cryptograph, he cried, unless, indeed, the letters have been written without any real meaning, and yet why take so much trouble? Who knows but I may be on the verge of some great discovery. My candid opinion was that it was all rubbish. But this opinion I kept carefully to myself, as my uncle's choler was not pleasant to bear. All this time he was comparing the book with the parchment. The manuscript volume and the smaller document are written in different hands, he said, the cryptograph is of much later date than the book, there is an undoubted proof of the correctness of my surmise. An irrefragable proof I took it to be, the first letter is a double M, which was only added to the Icelandic language in the 12th century. This makes the parchment 200 years posterior to the volume. The circumstances appeared very probable and very logical, but it was all surmise to me. To me it appears probable that this sentence was written by some owner of the book. Now who is the owner, is the next important question. Perhaps by great good luck it may be written somewhere in the volume. With these words Professor Hardwig took off his spectacles, and, taking a powerful magnifying glass, examined the book carefully. On the fly leaf was what appeared to be a blot of ink, but on examination proved to be a line of writing almost effaced by time. This was what he saw, and, after some considerable time, he made out these letters. Illustration, runic glyphs. Arni Saknussemm. He cried in a joyous and triumphant tone, that is not only an Icelandic name, but of a learned professor of the 16th century, a celebrated alchemist. I bowed as a sign of respect. These alchemists, he continued, Avicenna, Bacon, Lully, Paracelsus, were the true, the only learned men of the day. They made surprising discoveries. May not this Saknussemm, nephew mine, have hidden on this bit of parchment some astounding invention? I believe the cryptograph to have a profound meaning which I must make out. My uncle walked about the room in a state of excitement almost impossible to describe. It may be so, sir, I timidly observed, but why conceal it from posterity, if it be a useful, a worthy discovery? Why, how should I know? Did not Galileo make a secret of his discoveries in connection with Saturn? But we shall see. Until I discover the meaning of this sentence I will neither eat nor sleep. My dear uncle, I began. Nor you neither, he added. It was lucky I had taken double allowance that day. In the first place, he continued, there must be a clue to the meaning. If we could find that, the rest would be easy enough. I began seriously to reflect. The prospect of going without food and sleep was not a promising one, so I determined to do my best to solve the mystery. My uncle, meanwhile, went on with his soliloquy. The way to discover it is easy enough. In this document there are 132 letters, giving 79 consonants to 53 vowels. This is about the proportion found in most southern languages, the idioms of the north being much more rich in consonants. We may confidently predict, therefore, that we have to deal with a southern dialect. Nothing could be more logical. Now, said Professor Hardwig, to trace the particular language. As Shakespeare says, that is the question, was my rather satirical reply. This man Saknussemm, he continued, was a very learned man. Now, as he did not write in the language of his birthplace, he probably, like most learned men of the 16th century, wrote in Latin. If, however, I prove wrong in this guess, we must try Spanish, French, Italian, Greek, and even Hebrew. My own opinion, though, is decidedly in favor of Latin. This proposition startled me. Latin was my favorite study, and it seemed sacrilege to believe this gibberish to belong to the country of Virgil. Barbarous Latin, in all probability, continued my uncle, but still Latin. Very probably, I replied, not to contradict him. Let us see into the matter, continued my uncle. Here you see we have a series of 132 letters, apparently thrown pell-mell upon paper, without method or organization. There are words which are composed wholly of consonants, such as im.rnlls/i, others which are nearly all vowels, the fifth, for instance, which is untief, and one of the last acibo. This appears an extraordinary combination. Probably we shall find that the phrase is arranged according to some mathematical plan. No doubt a certain sentence has been written out and then jumbled up some plan to which some figure is the clue. Now, Harry, to show your English wit, what is that figure? I could give him no hint. My thoughts were indeed far away. While he was speaking, I had caught sight of the portrait of my cousin Gretchen, and was wondering when she would return. We were affianced, and loved one another very sincerely. But my uncle, who never thought even of such sublunary matters, knew nothing of this. Without noticing my abstraction, the professor began reading the puzzling cryptograph all sorts of ways, according to some theory of his own. Presently, rousing my wondering attention, he dictated one precious attempt to me. I mildly handed it over to him. It read as follows. Imeshun kasenera.isftik.segnet emertni certseret, rotaf sadua. Ed next sadni lakhart nivlor jase rotrik sarb mutable ed mcmeritark silukoas lefensni. ". I could scarcely keep from laughing, while my uncle, on the contrary, got in a towering passion, struck the table with his fist, darted out of the room, out of the house, and then taking to his heels was presently lost to sight. Chapter 3. An astounding discovery. What is the matter? Cried the cook, entering the room. When will master have his dinner? Never. And, his supper? I don't know. He says he will eat no more, neither shall I. My uncle has determined to fast and make me fast until he makes out this abominable inscription, I replied. You'll be starved to death, she said. I was very much of the same opinion, but not liking to say so, sent her away, and began some of my usual work of classification. But try as I might, nothing could keep me from thinking alternately of the stupid manuscript and of the pretty Gretchen. Several times I thought of going out, but my uncle would have been angry at my absence. At the end of an hour, my allotted task was done. How to pass the time? I began by lighting my pipe. Like all other students, I delighted in tobacco, and, seating myself in the great armchair, I began to think. Where was my uncle? I could easily imagine him tearing along some solitary road, gesticulating, talking to himself, cutting the air with his cane, and still thinking of the absurd bit of hieroglyphics. Would he hit upon some clue? Would he come home in better humor? While these thoughts were passing through my brain, I mechanically took up the execrable puzzle and tried every imaginable way of grouping the letters. I put them together by twos, by threes, fours, and fives in vain. Nothing intelligible came out, except that the 14th, 15th, and 16th made ii/i in English, the 84th, 85th, and 86th, the word icer/i. Then at last I seemed to find the Latin words irota, metabile, ira, nec, atra/i. Ha! There seems to be some truth in my uncle's notion, thought I. Then again I seemed to find the word iluco/i, which means sacred wood. Then in the third line I appeared to make out ilabeled/i, a perfect Hebrew word, and at the last the syllables mir, ar, mer, which were French. It was enough to drive one mad. Four different idioms in this absurd phrase. What connection could there be between ice, sir, anger, cruel, sacred wood, changing, mother, r, and c? The first and the last might, in a sentence connected with Iceland, mean sea of ice. But what of the rest of this monstrous cryptograph? I was, in fact, fighting against an insurmountable difficulty. My brain was almost on fire, my eyes were strained with staring at the parchment, the whole absurd collection of letters appeared to dance before my vision in a number of black little groups. My mind was possessed with temporary hallucination I was stifling. I wanted air. Mechanically I fanned myself with the document, of which now I saw the back and then the front. Imagine my surprise when glancing at the back of the wearisome puzzle, the ink having gone through, I clearly made out Latin words, and among others crater emant terrestre. I had discovered the secret. It came upon me like a flash of lightning. I had got the clue. All you had to do to understand the document was to read it backwards. All the ingenious ideas of the professor were realized. He had dictated it rightly to me. By a mere accident I had discovered what he so much desired. My delight, my emotion may be imagined, my eyes were dazzled and I trembled so that at first I could make nothing of it. One look, however, would tell me all I wished to know. "Let me read," I said to myself, after drawing a long breath. I spread it before me on the table, I passed my finger over each letter, I spelled it through, in my excitement I read it out. What horror and stupefaction took possession of my soul. I was like a man who had received a knockdown blow. Was it possible that I really read the terrible secret, and it had really been accomplished? A man had dared to do what? No living being should ever know. "Never," cried I, jumping up. "Never shall my uncle be made aware of the dread secret. He would be quite capable of undertaking the terrible journey. Nothing would check him, nothing stopped him. Worse, he would compel me to accompany him, and we should be lost forever. But no, such folly and madness cannot be allowed." I was almost beside myself with rage and fury. "My worthy uncle is already nearly mad," I cried aloud. "This would finish him. By some accident he may make the discovery, in which case, we are both lost. Perish the fearful secret, let the flames forever bury it in oblivion." I snatched up book and parchment, and was about to cast them into the fire, when the door opened and my uncle entered. I had scarcely time to put down the wretched documents before my uncle was by my side. He was profoundly absorbed. His thoughts were evidently bent on the terrible parchment. Some new combination had probably struck him while taking his walk. He seated himself in his armchair, and with a pen began to make an algebraical calculation. I watched him with anxious eyes. My flesh crawled as it became probable that he would discover the secret. His combinations I knew now were useless, I having discovered the one only clue. For 3 mortal hours he continued without speaking a word, without raising his head, scratching, rewriting, calculating over and over again. I knew that in time he must hit upon the right phrase. The letters of every alphabet have only a certain number of combinations. But then years might elapse before he would arrive at the correct solution. Still time went on, night came, the sounds in the streets ceased and still my uncle went on, not even answering our worthy cook when she called us to supper. I did not dare to leave him, so waved her away, and at last fell asleep on the sofa. When I awoke my uncle was still at work. His red eyes, his pallid countenance, his matted hair, his feverish hands, his hectically flushed cheeks, showed how terrible had been his struggle with the impossible, and what fearful fatigue he had undergone during that long sleepless night. It made me quite ill to look at him. Though he was rather severe with me, I loved him, and my heart ached at his sufferings. He was so overcome by one idea that he could not even get in a passion. All his energies were focused on one point. And I knew that by speaking one little word all this suffering would cease. I could not speak it. My heart was, nevertheless, inclining towards him. Why, then, did I remain silent? In the interest of my uncle himself. "Nothing shall make me speak," I muttered. "He will want to follow in the footsteps of the other. I know him well. His imagination is a perfect volcano, and to make discoveries in the interests of geology he would sacrifice his life. I will therefore be silent and strictly keep the secret I have discovered. To reveal it would be suicidal. He would not only rush, himself, to destruction, but drag me with him." I crossed my arms, looked another way and smoked, resolved never to speak. When our cook wanted to go out to market, or on any other errand, she found the front door locked and the key taken away. Was this done purposely or not? Surely Professor Hardwig did not intend the old woman and myself to become martyrs to his obstinate will. Were we to be starved to death? A frightful recollection came to my mind. Once we had fed on bits and scraps for a week while he sorted some curiosities. It gave me the cramp even to think of it. I wanted my breakfast, and I saw no way of getting it. Still my resolution held good. I would starve rather than yield. But the cook began to take me seriously to task. What was to be done? She could not go out, and I dared not. My uncle continued counting and writing. His imagination seemed to have translated him to the skies. He neither thought of eating nor drinking. In this way 12 o'clock came round. I was hungry, and there was nothing in the house. The cook had eaten the last bit of bread. This could not go on. It did, however, Until 2, when my sensations were terrible. After all, I began to think the document very absurd. Perhaps it might only be a gigantic hoax. Besides, some means would surely be found to keep my uncle back from attempting any such absurd expedition. On the other hand, if he did attempt anything so quixotic, I should not be compelled to accompany him. Another line of reasoning partially decided me. Very likely he would make the discovery himself when I should have suffered starvation for nothing. Under the influence of hunger, this reasoning appeared admirable. I determined to tell all. The question now arose as to how it was to be done. I was still dwelling on the thought, when he rose and put on his hat. What? Go out and lock us in? Never. Uncle, I began. He did not appear even to hear me. Professor Hardwig, I cried. What, he retorted, did you speak? How about the key? What key? The key of the door. Know of these horrible hieroglyphics? He looked at me from under his spectacles, and started at the odd expression of my face. Rushing forward, he clutched me by the arm and keenly examined my countenance. His very look was an interrogation. I simply nodded. With an incredulous shrug of the shoulders, he turned upon his heel. Undoubtedly he thought I had gone mad. I have made a very important discovery. His eyes flashed with excitement. His hand was lifted in a menacing attitude. For a moment neither of us spoke. It is hard to say which was most excited. You don't mean to say that you have any idea of the meaning of the scrawl? I do, was my desperate reply. Look at the sentence as dictated by you. Well, but it means nothing, was the angry answer. Nothing if you read from left to right, but mark, if from right to left. Backwards! Cried my uncle, in wild amazement. O most cunning Saknussemm, and I to be such a blockhead! He snatched up the document, gazed at it with haggard eye, and read it out as I had done. It read as follows. I in Sneffels Ioculus Crater M. Chem. Delibatum Briscartaris Julii Intra Calendas Descent, O Dos Viator, et Terrestre Centrum Adinges. Could Fetchi. Arni Saknussemm / I. Which Dog Latin being translated, reads as follows. Descend into the crater of Yokel of Sneffels, which the shade of Scartaris caresses, before the calends of July, audacious traveler, and you will reach the center of the earth. I did it. Arni Saknussemm. My uncle leapt 3 feet from the ground with joy. He looked radiant and handsome. He rushed about the room wild with delight and satisfaction. He knocked over tables and chairs. He threw his books about until at last, utterly exhausted, he fell into his armchair. What's o'clock? He asked. About 3. My dinner does not seem to have done me much good, he observed. Let me have something to eat. We can then start at once. Get my portmanteau ready. What for? And your own, he continued. We start at once. My horror may be conceived. I resolved, however, to show no fear. Scientific reasons were the only ones likely to influence my uncle. Now, there were many against this terrible journey. The very idea of going down to the center of the earth was simply absurd. I determined therefore to argue the point after dinner. My uncle's rage was now directed against the cook for having no dinner ready. My explanation, however, satisfied him, and having gotten the key, she soon contrived to get sufficient to satisfy our voracious appetites. During the repast, my uncle was rather gay than otherwise. He made some of those peculiar jokes which belong exclusively to the learned. As soon, however, as dessert was over, he called me to his study. We each took a chair on opposite sides of the table. Henry, he said, in a soft and winning voice, I have always believed you ingenious, and you have rendered me a service never to be forgotten. Without you, this great, this wondrous discovery would never have been made. It is my duty, therefore, to insist on your sharing the glory. He is in a good humor, thought I, I'll soon let him know my opinion of glory. In the first place, he continued, you must keep the whole affair a profound secret. There is no more envious race of men than scientific discoverers. Many would start on the same journey. At all events, we will be the first in the field. I doubt your having many competitors, was my reply. A man of real scientific acquirements would be delighted at the chance. We should find a perfect stream of pilgrims on the traces of Arni Saknussemm, if this document were once made public. But, my dear sir, is not this paper very likely to be a hoax? I urged. The book in which we find it is sufficient proof of its authenticity, he replied. I thoroughly allow that the celebrated professor wrote the lines, but only, I believe, as a kind of mystification, was my answer. Scarcely were the words out of my mouth, when I was sorry I had uttered them. My uncle looked at me with a dark and gloomy scowl, and I began to be alarmed for the results of our conversation. His mood soon changed, however, and a smile took the place of a frown. "We shall see," he remarked, with decisive emphasis. "But see, what is all this about Yokel, and Sneffels, and this Skartaris? I have never heard anything about them. The very point to which I am coming. I lately received from my friend Augustus Peterman, of Leipzig, a map. Take down the third atlas from the second shelf, Series Z, Plate 4. I rose, went to the shelf, and presently returned with the volume indicated. "This," said my uncle, "is one of the best maps of Iceland. I believe it will settle all your doubts, difficulties and objections." With a grim hope to the contrary, I stooped over the map. Chapter 4. We start on the journey. "You see, the whole island is composed of volcanoes," said the professor, and remarked carefully that they all bear the name of Jokul. The word is Icelandic, and means a glacier. In most of the lofty mountains of that region the volcanic eruptions come forth from ice-bound caverns. Hence the name applied to every volcano on this extraordinary island. But what does this word Sneffels mean? To this question I expected no rational answer. I was mistaken. "Follow my finger to the western coast of Iceland, there you see Reykjavik, its capital. Follow the direction of one of its innumerable fjords or arms of the sea, and what do you see below the 65th degree of latitude? A peninsula very like a thigh bone in shape. And in the center of it? A mountain. Well, that's Sneffels." I had nothing to say. "That is Sneffels, a mountain about 5,000 feet in height, one of the most remarkable in the whole island, and certainly doomed to be the most celebrated in the world, for through its crater we shall reach the center of the earth." "Impossible!" cried I, startled and shocked at the thought. "Why impossible?" said Professor Hardwig in his severest tones. "Because its crater is choked with lava, by burning rocks, by infinite dangers. But if it be extinct? That would make a difference." "Of course it would. There are about 300 volcanoes on the whole surface of the globe, but the greater number are extinct. Of these, Sneffels is one. No eruption has occurred since 1219, in fact it has ceased to be a volcano at all." After this, what more could I say? Yes, I thought of another objection. "But what is all this about Skartaris and the Kalends of July?" My uncle reflected deeply. Presently he gave forth the result of his reflections in a sententious tone. "What appears obscure to you, to me is light." This very phrase shows how particular Sacnus M. is in his directions. The Sneffels mountain has many craters. He is careful therefore to point the exact one which is the highway into the interior of the earth. He lets us know, for this purpose, that about the end of the month of June, the shadow of Mount Skartaris falls upon the one crater. There can be no doubt about the matter. My uncle had an answer for everything. "I accept all your explanations," I said, "and Sacnus M. is right. He found out the entrance to the bowels of the earth, he is indicated correctly, but that he or anyone else ever followed up the discovery is madness to suppose." "Why so, young man?" "All scientific teaching, theoretical and practical, shows it to be impossible." "I care nothing for theories," retorted my uncle. "But is it not well known that heat increases 1 degree for every 70 feet you descend into the earth? Which gives a fine idea of the central heat. All the matters which compose the globe are in a state of incandescence, even gold, platinum, and the hardest rocks are in a state of fusion. What would become of us? Don't be alarmed at the heat, my boy." "How so?" "Neither you nor anybody else know anything about the real state of the Earth's interior. All modern experiments tend to explode the older theories. Were any such heat to exist, the upper crust of the Earth would be shattered to atoms, and the world would be at an end." A long, learned and not uninteresting discussion followed, which ended in this wise. "I do not believe in the dangers and difficulties which you, Henry, seem to multiply, and the only way to learn, is like Harney Sacnus M., to go and see." "Well," cried I, overcome at last, "let us go and see. Though how we can do that in the dark is another mystery." "Fear nothing. We shall overcome these, and many other difficulties. Besides, as we approach the center, I expect to find it luminous. Nothing is impossible. And now that we have come to a thorough understanding, not a word to any living soul. Our success depends on secrecy and dispatch." Thus ended our memorable conference, which roused a perfect fever in me. Leaving my uncle, I went forth like one possessed. Reaching the banks of the Elbe, I began to think. Was all I had heard really and truly possible? Was my uncle in his sober senses, and could the interior of the earth be reached? Was I the victim of a madman, or was he a discoverer of rare courage and grandeur of conception? To a certain extent, I was anxious to be off. I was afraid my enthusiasm would cool. I determined to pack up at once. At the end of an hour, however, on my way home, I found that my feelings had very much changed. "I'm all abroad," I cried, "'tis a nightmare, I must have dreamed it." At this moment I came face to face with Gretchen, whom I warmly embraced. "So you have come to meet me," she said, "how good of you. But what is the matter?" Well, it was no use mincing the matter, I told her all. She listened with awe, and for some minutes she could not speak. "Well?" I at last said, rather anxiously. "What a magnificent journey! If I were only a man. A journey worthy of the nephew of Professor Hardwig. I should look upon it as an honor to accompany him." "My dear Gretchen, I thought you would be the first to cry out against this mad enterprise." "No, on the contrary, I glory in it. It is magnificent, splendid, an idea worthy of my father. Henry Lawson, I envy you." This was, as it were, conclusive. The final blow of all? When we entered the house, we found my uncle surrounded by workmen and porters, who were packing up. He was pulling and hauling at a bell. "Where have you been wasting your time? Your portmanteau is not packed, my papers are not in order, the precious tailor has not brought my clothes, nor my gaiters, the key of my carpet bag is gone." I looked at him stupefied. And still he tugged away at the bell. "We are really off, then?" I said. "Yes, of course, and yet you go out for a stroll, unfortunate boy." "And when do we go?" "The day after tomorrow, at daybreak." I heard no more, but darted off to my little bedchamber and locked myself in. There was no doubt about it now. My uncle had been hard at work all the afternoon. The garden was full of ropes, rope ladders, torches, gourds, iron clamps, crowbars, alpenstocks, and pickaxes enough to load 10 men. I passed a terrible night. I was called early the next day to learn that the resolution of my uncle was unchanged and irrevocable. I also found my cousin and affianced wife as warm on the subject as was her father. Next day, at 5 o'clock in the morning, the postchaise was at the door. Gretchen and the old cook received the keys of the house, and, scarcely pausing to wish anyone goodbye, we started on our adventurous journey into the center of the earth. Chapter 5. First Lessons in Climbing. At Altona, a suburb of Hamburg, is the chief station of the Kiel Railway, which was to take us to the shores of the Belt. In 20 minutes from the moment of our departure we were in Holstein, and our carriage entered the station. Our heavy luggage was taken out, weighed, labeled, and placed in a huge van. We then took our tickets, and exactly at 7 o'clock were seated opposite each other in a first-class railway carriage. My uncle said nothing. He was too busy examining his papers, among which of course was the famous parchment, and some letters of introduction from the Danish consul which were to pave the way to an introduction to the governor of Iceland. My only amusement was looking out of the window. But as we passed through a flat though fertile country, this occupation was slightly monotonous. In 3 hours we reached Kiel, and our baggage was at once transferred to the steamer. We had now a day before us, a delay of about 10 hours. Which fact put my uncle in a towering passion. We had nothing to do but to walk about the pretty town and bay. At length, however, we went on board, and at 10:30 were steaming down the Great Belt. It was a dark night, with a strong breeze and a rough sea, nothing being visible but the occasional fires on shore, with here and there a lighthouse. At 7 in the morning we left Korsør, a little town on the western side of Zealand. Here we took another railway, which in 3 hours brought us to the capital, Copenhagen, where, scarcely taking time for refreshment, my uncle hurried out to present one of his letters of introduction. It was to the director of the Museum of Antiquities, who, having been informed that we were tourists bound for Iceland, did all he could to assist us. One wretched hope sustained me now. Perhaps no vessel was bound for such distant parts. Alas! A little Danish schooner, the I Valkyrie/I, was to sail on the 2nd of June for Reykjavik. The captain, M. Bjorn, was on board, and was rather surprised at the energy and cordiality with which his future passenger shook him by the hand. To him a voyage to Iceland was merely a matter of course. My uncle, on the other hand, considered the event of sublime importance. The honest sailor took advantage of the professor's enthusiasm to double the fare. "On Tuesday morning at 7 o'clock be on board," said M. Bjorn, handing us our receipts. "Excellent. Capital. Glorious," remarked my uncle as we sat down to a late breakfast. "Refresh yourself, my boy, and we will take a run through the town." Our meal concluded, We went to the Kongsnytor, to the king's magnificent palace, to the beautiful bridge over the canal near the museum, to the immense cenotaph of Thorvaldsen with its hideous naval groups, to the castle of Rosenborg, and to all the other lions of the place, none of which my uncle even saw, so absorbed was he in his anticipated triumphs. But one thing struck his fancy, and that was a certain singular steeple situated on the island of Amak, which is the southeast quarter of the city of Copenhagen. My uncle at once ordered me to turn my steps that way, and accordingly we went on board the steam ferry boat which does duty on the canal, and very soon reached the noted dockyard quay. In the first instance we crossed some narrow streets, where we met numerous groups of galley slaves, with party-colored trousers, gray and yellow, working under the orders and the sticks of severe taskmasters, and finally reached the Vorfrelsers Kirk. This church exhibited nothing remarkable in itself. In fact, the worthy professor had only been attracted to it by one circumstance, which was, that its rather elevated steeple started from a circular platform, after which there was an exterior staircase, which wound round to the very summit. "Let us ascend," said my uncle. "But I never could climb church towers," I cried, "I am subject to dizziness in my head." "The very reason why you should go up. I want to cure you of a bad habit." "But, my good sir, I tell you to come. What is the use of wasting so much valuable time?" It was impossible to dispute the dictatorial commands of my uncle. I yielded with a groan. On payment of a fee, a verger gave us the key. He, for one, was not partial to the ascent. My uncle at once showed me the way, running up the steps like a schoolboy. I followed as well as I could, though no sooner was I outside the tower, than my head began to swim. There was nothing of the eagle about me. The earth was enough for me, and no ambitious desire to soar ever entered my mind. Still, things did not go badly until I had ascended 150 steps, and was near the platform, when I began to feel the rush of cold air. I could scarcely stand, when clutching the railings, I looked upwards. The railing was frail enough, but nothing to those which skirted the terrible winding staircase, that appeared, from where I stood, to ascend to the skies. "Now then, Henry. I can't do it," I cried, in accents of despair. "Are you, after all, a coward, sir?" said my uncle in a pitiless tone. "Go up, I say." To this there was no reply possible. And yet the keen air acted violently on my nervous system. Sky, earth, all seemed to swim round, while the steeple rocked like a ship. My legs gave way like those of a drunken man. I crawled upon my hands and knees, I hauled myself up slowly, crawling like a snake. Presently I closed my eyes, and allowed myself to be dragged upwards. "Look around you," said my uncle in a stern voice, "heaven knows what profound abysses you may have to look down. This is excellent practice." Slowly, and shivering all the while with cold, I opened my eyes. What then did I see? My first glance was upwards at the cold fleecy clouds, which as by some optical delusion appeared to stand still, while the steeple, the weathercock, and our two selves were carried swiftly along. Far away on one side could be seen the grassy plain, while on the other lay the sea bathed in translucent light. The sund, or sound as we call it, could be discovered beyond the point of Elsinore, crowded with white sails, which, at that distance looked like the wings of seagulls, while to the east could be made out the far-off coast of Sweden. The whole appeared a magic panorama. But faint and bewildered as I was, there was no remedy for it. Rise and stand up I must. Despite my protestations, my first lesson lasted quite an hour. When, nearly 2 hours later, I reached the bosom of Mother Earth, I was like a rheumatic old man bent double with pain. "Enough for one day," said my uncle, rubbing his hands, "we will begin again tomorrow." There was no remedy. My lessons lasted 5 days, and at the end of that period, I ascended blithely enough, and found myself able to look down into the depths below without even winking, and with some degree of pleasure. Chapter 6. Our voyage to Iceland. The hour of departure came at last. The night before, the worthy Mr. Thompson brought us the most cordial letters of introduction for Baron Tramp, Governor of Iceland, for M. Pictureson, Coadjutor to the Bishop, and for M. Finson, Mayor of the town of Reykjavik. In return, my uncle nearly crushed his hands, so warmly did he shake them. On the 2nd of the month, at 2 in the morning, our precious cargo of luggage was taken on board the good ship I Valkyrie/I. We followed, and were very politely introduced by the captain to a small cabin with 2 standing bed places, neither very well ventilated nor very comfortable. But in the cause of science men are expected to suffer. "Well, and have we a fair wind?" cried my uncle, in his most mellifluous accents. "An excellent wind," replied Captain Bjorn, We shall leave the Sound, going free with all sails set. A few minutes afterwards, the schooner started before the wind, under all the canvas she could carry, and entered the channel. An hour later, the capital of Denmark seemed to sink into the waves, and we were at no great distance from the coast of Elsinore. My uncle was delighted. For myself, moody and dissatisfied, I appeared almost to expect a glimpse of the ghost of Hamlet. "Sublime madman," thought I, "you doubtless would approve our proceedings. You might perhaps even follow us to the center of the earth, there to resolve your eternal doubts." But no ghost or anything else appeared upon the ancient walls. The fact is, the castle is much later than the time of the heroic Prince of Denmark. It is now the residence of the keeper of the Strait of the Sound, and through that sound more than 15,000 vessels of all nations pass every year. The castle of Kronborg soon disappeared in the murky atmosphere, as well as the Tower of Helsingborg, which raises its head on the Swedish bank. And here the schooner began to feel in earnest the breezes of the Kattegat. The I-Valkyrie/I was swift enough, but with all sailing boats there is the same uncertainty. Her cargo was coal, furniture, pottery, woolen clothing, and a load of corn. As usual, the crew was small, 5 Danes doing the whole of the work. "How long will the voyage last?" asked my uncle. "Well, I should think about 10 days, replied the skipper, "unless, indeed, we meet with some northeast gales among the Faroe Islands." "At all events, there will be no very considerable delay," cried the impatient professor. "No, Mr. Hardwig," said the captain, "no fear of that. At all events, we shall get there some day." Towards evening the schooner doubled Cape Skagen, the northernmost part of Denmark, crossed the Skagerrak during the night, skirted the extreme point of Norway through the gut of Cape Lindesnes, and then reached the northern seas. 2 days later we were not far from the coast of Scotland, somewhere near what Danish sailors call Peterhead, and then the I-Valkyrie/I stretched out direct for the Faroe Islands, between Orkney and Shetland. Our vessel now felt the full force of the ocean waves, and the wind shifting, we with great difficulty made the Faroe Isles. On the 8th day, the captain made out Mykines, the westernmost of the isles, and from that moment headed direct for Portland, a cape on the southern shores of the singular island for which we were bound. The voyage offered no incident worthy of record. I bore it very well, but my uncle, to his great annoyance, and even shame, was remarkably seasick. This mal de mer troubled him the more that it prevented him from questioning Captain Bjarne to the subject of sniffles, as to the means of communication, and the facilities of transport. All these explanations he had to adjourn to the period of his arrival. His time, meanwhile, was spent lying in bed groaning, and dwelling anxiously on the hope for termination of the voyage. I didn't pity him. On the 11th day we sighted Cape Portland, over which towered Mount Myrtle's Yokel, which, the weather being clear, we made out very readily. The cape itself is nothing but a huge mound of granite standing naked and alone to meet the Atlantic waves. The I-Valkyrie/I kept off the coast, steering to the westward. On all sides were to be seen whole schools of whales and sharks. After some hours we came in sight of a solitary rock in the ocean, forming a mighty vault, through which the foaming waves poured with intense fury. The islets of Westman appeared to leap from the ocean, being so low in the water as scarcely to be seen until you were right upon them. From that moment the schooner was steered to the westward in order to round Cape Reykjanes, the western point of Iceland. My uncle, to his great disgust, was unable even to crawl on deck, so heavy as he was on, and thus lost the first view of the land of promise. 48 hours later, after a storm which drove us far to sea under bare poles, we came once more in sight of land, and were boarded by a pilot, who, after 3 hours of dangerous navigation, brought the schooner safely to an anchor in the Bay of Faxa before Reykjavik. My uncle came out of his cabin pale, haggard, thin, but full of enthusiasm, his eyes dilated with pleasure and satisfaction. Nearly the whole population of the town was on foot to see us land. The fact was, that scarcely any one of them but expected some goods by the periodical vessel. Professor Hardwig was in haste to leave his prison, or rather as he called it, his hospital, but before he attempted to do so, he caught hold of my hand, led me to the quarter-deck of the schooner, took my arm with his left hand, and pointed inland with his right, over the northern part of the bay, to where arose a high 2-peaked mountain, a double cone covered with eternal snow. "Behold," he whispered in an awe-stricken voice, "behold Mount Sneffels." Then without further remark, he put his finger to his lips, frowned darkly, and descended into the small boat which awaited us. I followed, and in a few minutes we stood upon the soil of mysterious Iceland. Scarcely were we fairly on shore when there appeared before us a man of excellent appearance, wearing the costume of a military officer. He was, however, but a civil servant, a magistrate, the governor of the island Barentrap. The professor knew whom he had to deal with. He therefore handed him the letters from Copenhagen, and a brief conversation in Danish followed, to which I of course was a stranger, and for a very good reason, for I did not know the language in which they conversed. I afterwards heard, however, that Barentrap placed himself entirely at the beck and call of Professor Hardwig. My uncle was most graciously received by M. Finson, the mayor, who as far as costume went, was quite as military as the governor, but also from character and occupation quite as pacific. As for his coadjutor, M. Pictureson, he was absent on an episcopal visit to the northern portion of the diocese. We were therefore compelled to defer the pleasure of being presented to him. His absence was, however, more than compensated by the presence of M. Fredriksen, professor of natural science in the College of Reykjavik, a man of invaluable ability. This modest scholar spoke no languages save Icelandic and Latin. When, therefore, he addressed himself to me in the language of Horace, we at once came to understand one another. He was, in fact, the only person that I did thoroughly understand during the whole period of my residence in this benighted island. Out of three rooms of which his house was composed, two were placed at our service, and in a few hours we were installed with all our baggage, the amount of which rather astonished the simple inhabitants of Reykjavik. "Now, Harry," said my uncle, rubbing his hands, "and goes well, the worst difficulty is now over." "How the worst difficulty over?" I cried in fresh amazement. "Doubtless. Here we are in Iceland. Nothing more remains but to descend into the bowels of the earth." "Well, sir, to a certain extent you are right. We have only to go down, but, as far as I am concerned, that is not the question. I want to know how we are to get up again. That is the least part of the business, and does not in any way trouble me. In the meantime, there is not an hour to lose. I am about to visit the public library. Very likely I may find there some manuscripts from the hand of Saknussemm. I shall be glad to consult them. In the meanwhile," I replied, "I will take a walk through the town. Will you not likewise do so?" "I feel no interest in the subject," said my uncle. "What for me is curious in this island, is not what is above the surface, but what is below." I bowed by way of reply, put on my hat and furred cloak, and went out. It was not an easy matter to lose oneself in the two streets of Reykjavik, I had therefore no need to ask my way. The town lies on a flat and marshy plain, between two hills. A vast field of lava skirts it on one side, falling away in terraces towards the sea. On the other hand is the large bay of Faxa, bordered on the north by the enormous glacier of Sneffels, and in which bay the I Valkyrie/I was then the only vessel at anchor. Generally there were one or two English or French gunboats, to watch and protect the fisheries in the offing. They were now, however, absent on duty. The longest of the streets of Reykjavik runs parallel to the shore. In this street the merchants and traders live in wooden huts made with beams of wood, painted red mere log huts, such as you find in the wilds of America. The other street, situated more to the west, runs toward a little lake between the residences of the bishop and the other personages not engaged in commerce. I had soon seen all I wanted of these weary and dismal thoroughfares. Here and there was a strip of discolored turf, like an old worn-out bit of woolen carpet, and now and then a bit of kitchen garden, in which grew potatoes, cabbage, and lettuce, almost diminutive enough to suggest the idea of Lilliput. In the center of the new commercial street, I found the public cemetery, enclosed by an earthen wall. Though not very large, it appeared not likely to be filled for centuries. From hence I went to the house of the governor, a mere hut in comparison with the mansion house of Hamburg, but a palace alongside the other Icelandic houses. Between the little lake and the town was the church, built in simple Protestant style, and composed of calcined stones, thrown up by volcanic action. I have not the slightest doubt that in high winds its red tiles were blown out, to the great annoyance of the pastor and congregation. Upon an eminence close at hand was the national school, in which were taught Hebrew, English, French, and Danish. In 3 hours my tour was complete. The general impression upon my mind was sadness. No trees, no vegetation, so to speak, on all sides volcanic peaks, the huts of turf and earth more like roofs than houses. Thanks to the heat of these residences, grass grows on the roof, which grass is carefully cut for hay. I saw but few inhabitants during my excursion, but I met a crowd on the beach, drying, salting and loading codfish, the principal article of exportation. The men appeared robust but heavy, fair-haired like Germans, but of pensive mien, exiles of a higher scale in the ladder of humanity than the Eskimos, but, I thought, much more unhappy, since with superior perceptions they are compelled to live within the limits of the polar circle. Sometimes they gave vent to a convulsive laugh, but by no chance did they smile. Their costume consists of a coarse capote of black wool, known in Scandinavian countries as the vedmal, a broad-brimmed hat, trousers of red serge, and a piece of leather tied with strings for a shoe, a coarse kind of moccasin. The women, though sad-looking and mournful, had rather agreeable features, without much expression. They wear a bodice and petticoat of somber vedmal. When unmarried they wear a little brown knitted cap over a crown of plaited hair, but when married, they cover their heads with a colored handkerchief, over which they tie a white scarf. Chapter 7. Conversation and Discovery. When I returned, dinner was ready. This meal was devoured by my worthy relative with avidity and voracity. His shipboard diet had turned his interior into a perfect gulf. The repast, which was more Danish than Icelandic, was in itself nothing, but the excessive hospitality of our host made us enjoy it doubly. The conversation turned upon scientific matters, and M. Fredriksen asked my uncle what he thought of the public library. "Library, sir?" cried my uncle, "it appears to me a collection of useless odd volumes, and a beggarly amount of empty shelves." "What?" cried M. Fredriksen, "why, we have 8,000 volumes of most rare and valuable works, some in the Scandinavian language, besides all the new publications from Copenhagen."
8,000 volumes, my dear sir, why, where are they?" cried my uncle.
"Scattered over the country, Professor Hardwig. We are very studious, my dear sir, though we do live in Iceland. Every farmer, every laborer, every fisherman can both read and write, and we think that books, instead of being locked up in cupboards, far from the sight of students, should be distributed as widely as possible. The books of our library are therefore passed from hand to hand without returning to the library shelves perhaps for years."
"Then when foreigners visit you, there is nothing for them to see?"
"Well, sir, foreigners have their own libraries, and our first consideration is that our humbler classes should be highly educated. Fortunately, the love of study is innate in the Icelandic people. In 1816 we founded a literary society and mechanics institute. Many foreign scholars of eminence are honorary members. We publish books destined to educate our people, and these books have rendered valuable services to our country. Allow me to have the honor, Professor Hardwig, to enroll you as an honorary member."
My uncle, who already belonged to nearly every literary and scientific institution in Europe, immediately yielded to the amiable wishes of good M. Fredriksen.
"And now," he said, after many expressions of gratitude and goodwill, "if you will tell me what books you expected to find, perhaps I may be of some assistance to you."
I watched my uncle keenly. For a minute or two he hesitated, as if unwilling to speak openly was, perhaps, to unveil his projects. Nevertheless, after some reflection, he made up his mind.
"Well, M. Fredriksen," he said in an easy, unconcerned kind of way, "I was desirous of ascertaining, if among other valuable works, you had any of the learned Arne Saknussemm."
"Arne Saknussemm?" cried the professor of Reykjavik, "you speak of one of the most distinguished scholars of the 16th century, of the great naturalist, the great alchemist, the great traveler."
"Exactly so. One of the most distinguished men connected with Icelandic science and literature.
As you say, sir. A man illustrious above all."
"Yes, sir, all this is true, but his works?"
"We have none of them."
"Not in Iceland?"
"There are none in Iceland or elsewhere," answered the other, sadly.
"Why so?"
"Because Arne Saknussemm was persecuted for heresy, and in 1573 his works were publicly burned at Copenhagen, by the hands of the common hangman."
"Very good. Capital," murmured my uncle, to the great astonishment of the worthy Icelander.
"You said, sir?"
"Yes, yes, all is clear, I see the link in the chain, everything is explained, and I now understand why Arne Saknussemm, put out of court, forced to hide his magnificent discoveries, was compelled to conceal beneath the veil of an incomprehensible cryptograph, the secret."
"What secret?"
"A secret which," stammered my uncle.
"Have you discovered some wonderful manuscript?" cried M. Fredriksen.
"No. No, I was carried away by my enthusiasm. A mere supposition."
"Very good, sir. But, really, to turn to another subject, I hope you will not leave our island without examining into its mineralogical riches."
"Well, the fact is, I am rather late. So many learned men have been here before me."
"Yes, yes, but there is still much to be done," cried M. Fredriksen.
"You think so," said my uncle, his eyes twinkling with hidden satisfaction.
"Yes, You have no idea how many unknown mountains, glaciers, volcanoes there are which remain to be studied. Without moving from where we sit, I can show you one. Yonder on the edge of the horizon, you see Sneffels.
Oh yes, Sneffels, said my uncle.
One of the most curious volcanoes in existence, the crater of which has been rarely visited.
Extinct?
Extinct, any time these 500 years, was the ready reply.
Well, said my uncle, who dug his nails into his flesh, and pressed his knees tightly together to prevent himself leaping up with joy.
I have a great mind to begin my studies with an examination of the geological mysteries of this Mount Sneffelsfisel. What do you call it?
Sneffels, my dear sir.
This portion of the conversation took place in Latin, and I therefore understood all that had been said. I could scarcely keep my countenance when I found my uncle so cunningly concealing his delight and satisfaction. I must confess that his artful grimaces, put on to conceal his happiness, made him look like a new Mephistopheles.
Yes, yes, he continued, your proposition delights me. I will endeavor to climb to the summit of Sneffels, and, if possible, will descend into its crater.
I very much regret, continued M. Fridrikson, that my occupation will entirely preclude the possibility of my accompanying you. It would have been both pleasurable and profitable if I could have spared the time.
No, no, a thousand times no, cried my uncle. I do not wish to disturb the serenity of any man. I thank you, however, with all my heart. The presence of one so learned as yourself would no doubt have been most useful, but the duties of your office and profession before everything.
In the innocence of his simple heart, our host did not perceive the irony of these remarks.
I entirely approve your project, continued the Icelander after some further remarks. It is a good idea to begin by examining this volcano. You will make a harvest of curious observations. In the first place, how do you propose to get to Sneffels?
By sea. I shall cross the bay. Of course that is the most rapid route.
Of course. But still it cannot be done.
Why?
We have not an available boat in all Reykjavik, replied the other.
What is to be done?
You must go by land along the coast. It is longer, but much more interesting.
Then I must have a guide.
Of course, and I have your very man.
Somebody on whom I can depend.
Yes, an inhabitant of the peninsula on which Sneffels is situated. He is a very shrewd and worthy man, with whom you will be pleased. He speaks Danish like a Dane.
When can I see him today?
No, tomorrow. He will not be here before.
Tomorrow be it, replied my uncle, with a deep sigh.
The conversation ended by compliments on both sides. During the dinner my uncle had learned much as to the history of Arne Saknussemm, the reasons for his mysterious and hieroglyphical document. He also became aware that his host would not accompany him on his adventurous expedition, and that next day we should have a guide.
Chapter 8. The eiderdown hunter off at last. That evening I took a brief walk on the shore near Reykjavik, after which I returned to an early sleep on my bed of coarse planks, where I slept the sleep of the just. When I awoke I heard my uncle speaking loudly in the next room. I rose hastily and joined him. He was talking in Danish with a man of tall stature, and of perfectly Herculean build. This man appeared to be possessed of very great strength. His eyes, which started rather prominently from a very large head, the face belonging to which was simple and naive, appeared very quick and intelligent. Very long hair, which even in England would have been accounted exceedingly red, fell over his athletic shoulders. This native of Iceland was active and supple in appearance, though he scarcely moved his arms, being in fact one of those men who despise the habit of gesticulation common to southern people. Everything in this man's manner revealed a calm and phlegmatic temperament. There was nothing indolent about him, but his appearance spoke of tranquility. He was one of those who never seemed to expect anything from anybody, who liked to work when he thought proper, and whose philosophy nothing could astonish or trouble. I began to comprehend his character, simply from the way in which he listened to the wild and impassioned verbiage of my worthy uncle. While the excellent professor spoke sentence after sentence, he stood with folded arms, utterly still, motionless to all my uncle's gesticulations. When he wanted to say no he moved his head from left to right, when he acquiesced he nodded, so slightly that you could scarcely see the undulation of his head. This economy of motion was carried to the length of avarice. Judging from his appearance I should have been a long time before I had suspected him to be what he was, a mighty hunter. Certainly his manner was not likely to frighten the game. How, then, did he contrive to get at his prey? My surprise was slightly modified when I knew that this tranquil and solemn personage was only a hunter of the eider duck, the down of which is, after all, the greatest source of the Icelander's wealth. In the early days of summer, the female of the eider, a pretty sort of duck, builds its nest amid the rocks of the fjords, the name given to all narrow gulfs in Scandinavian countries with which every part of the island is indented. No sooner has the eider duck made her nest than she lines the inside of it with the softest down from her breast. Then comes the hunter or trader, taking away the nest. The poor bereaved female begins her task over again, and this continues as long as any eider down is to be found. When she can find no more, the male bird sets to work to see what he can do. As, however, his down is not so soft, and has therefore no commercial value, the hunter does not take the trouble to rob him of his nest lining. The nest is accordingly finished, the eggs are laid, the little ones are born, and next year the harvest of eider down is again collected. Now, as the eider duck never selects steep rocks or aspects to build its nest, but rather sloping and low cliffs near to the sea, the Icelandic hunter can carry on his trade operations without much difficulty. He is like a farmer who has neither to plow, to sow, nor to harrow, only to collect his harvest. This grave, sententious, silent person, as phlegmatic as an Englishman on the French stage, was named Hans Bjelke. He had called upon us in consequence of the recommendation of M. Fridrikson. He was, in fact, our future guide. It struck me that had I sought the world over, I could not have found a greater contradiction to my impulsive uncle. They, however, readily understood one another. Neither of them had any thought about money. One was ready to take all that was offered him, the other ready to offer anything that was asked. It may readily be conceived, then, that an understanding was soon come to between them. Now, the understanding was, that he was to take us to the village of Stapi, situated on the southern slope of the peninsula of Sneffels, at the very foot of the volcano. Hans, the guide, told us the distance was about 22 miles, a journey which my uncle supposed would take about 2 days. But when my uncle came to understand that they were Danish miles, of 8,000 yards each, he was obliged to be more moderate in his ideas, and, considering the horrible roads we had to follow, to allow 8 or 10 days for the journey. 4 horses were prepared for us, 2 to carry the baggage, and 2 to bear the important weight of myself and uncle. Hans declared that nothing ever would make him climb on the back of any animal. He knew every inch of that part of the coast, and promised to take us the very shortest way. His engagement with my uncle was by no means to cease with our arrival at Stapi. He was further to remain in his service during the whole time required for the completion of his scientific investigations, at the fixed salary of 3 rix dollars a week, being exactly 14 shillings and tuppence, minus 1 farthing, English currency. One stipulation, however, was made by the guide: the money was to be paid to him every Saturday night, failing which, his engagement was at an end. The day of our departure was fixed. My uncle wished to hand the eider down hunter in advance, but he refused in one emphatic word. Efter. Which, being translated from Icelandic into plain English, means after. The treaty concluded, our worthy guide retired without another word. A splendid fellow, said my uncle, only he little suspects the marvelous part he is about to play in the history of the world. You mean, then, I cried in amazement, that he should accompany us? To the interior of the earth, yes, replied my uncle. Why not? There were yet 48 hours to elapse before we made our final start. To my great regret, our whole time was taken up in making preparations for our journey. All our industry and ability were devoted to packing every object in the most advantageous manner.